You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. I'm Barney Hoskins and I'm in Hammersmith with my colleagues Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And Martin Collier.
Hi, Barney.
And Jasper Merrison Bowie.
Hello, Barney.
And joining us for this episode in person is music industry legend Rob Dickens. Welcome, Rob.
Hello, Barney.
In the 27 years that Rob worked for Warner Brothers here in the UK, he signed and shaped the careers of some of the biggest stars in the history of pop music, including Prince, Madonna, Cher, Enya, Rod Stewart, many more. We'll be talking about some, if not all, of those artists, and we'll be listening to clips from an audio interview with the late, great Leon Russell. First, Rob, let's go back to the beginning of your pop life, to cite the Prince song, because you were sort of embedded in the music business in many ways, weren't you?
Yeah, it's all I've ever known, basically. My father, who after the war and into the early 50s, worked on layout and printing at the Melody Maker. And in 1952... a guy called Maurice Kinn bought the Accordion Times and Music Express and wanted to sort of do a rival paper to the Melody Maker. And he hired Dad to do the advertising, the layout, the printing, all the kind of technical stuff. And so from 1952, so before my memory starts, there was an NME in the house. And when I was at school, of course, I got the NME the day before it hit the newsstand. So through the 60s, in my teenage years, you know, I became like a leader of the music people at school because I had the NME. So yes, it goes right back to then. And also Dad did the Poll Winners concert. So he was the kind of active runner of the Poll Winners concert. So I met the Beatles and the Stones when I was 12. I remember being in the corridor backstage at Wembley with my dad, and I was in my school uniform, and he said, "Oh, boys, come say hello to my son." And it was the Beatles. So I go back to 1962 to meet the Beatles. So constantly there was that. The other thing he did is, you know, as I was growing up, the review singles. So, you know, when they reviewed the singles every week, they would just leave them in the office. So he'd gather them up. And we're talking probably 12 records a week came out in those days.
Yeah.
So he'd come back with a briefcase and just empty them on the table. My brother and I would sort of
divvy them up.
Yeah. So we had A labels, again, before they were in the shop. So we had, I remember, you know, when Please Please Me came in. But so it was before, and in those days, radio didn't play up front of release. So, you know, we were hearing every new record before it actually hit the shop. So, and then as I got older and I read about Bob Dylan, I was 13, and I said, "Oh, I'd love Freewheeling by Bob Dylan." So, you know, he just rang up his friend at CBS and came home with Freewheeling. So, you know, I had a kind of free access to albums as well as singles.
So you were like in the market for freebies long before the first
before I knew what freebie meant.
Yeah,
it was just my method of attaining music.
Yeah.
Did you ever consider another career?
My mother, because, you know, I'm sure we got onto my brother, but my father was music business, my brother was music business, and it's all encompassing. You know, you have no life. You commit to the music business. And I went to university and I studied politics and Russian. And she thought, well, at least, you know, the first boy in the first family member of Dickens going to university, at least he won't be in the music business. but at university, I was social secretary for 2 years, chairman of events, chairman of the folk club, chairman of the jazz club, chairman of the film society.
Yeah, nothing to do with music at all.
I had my, the president of the students' union had an office, and I had an office with a red telephone, which,
smart.
1969 was quite something. And I used to, I had this office with all posters up and, stuff, so I kind of spent most of my time in that office.
Which university was this?
Loughborough.
Which, of course, was a lot of gigs were put on at Loughborough. Must have promoted a lot of those.
I did Pink Floyd, I did Faces, Motley Hoople, Paul Free.
Earth.
I did Earth, yeah. Yeah.
Later, Black Sabbath.
Is that right?
But it was a Wednesday night and they were still called Earth.
Gosh, you've done your research. Yeah.
We're Earth.
They were managed by someone in Birmingham and he kind of kept ringing us up because when you had the red phone, you got phone calls from managers and agents. trying to put because it was
the
hall held, I think, about 1,800 people.
Wow. So that was a proper gig.
It was a gig.
Umbra as a melody maker reader in the late 60s. Loughborough was one of those regular big student venues,
Yeah, yeah.
And Chris Briggs was at Leicester University, so we had this like 18 mile clause. So if you played Loughborough, you couldn't play Leicester within, I think, 6 months or a year. So it was like, because I remember he got the Who. And I couldn't get the Who because he had the same thing back to us. So.
Even your brother, though your brother had signed the Who.
And yeah, but my brother was 17, 18. My dad always said about my brother, he's like, if he signed you, once you fire him, you're going to be famous because the Who, he did McNamara and Beatle, all that stuff. Yeah. He did the transition from High Numbers. So by the time you got to the Who selling lots of records,
yeah.
They fired him because he was like a teenager. He couldn't do a tour of America. He couldn't do, like that. And then Jimi Hendrix fired him after the first, once he'd done Monterey, he saw the world as being bigger than what a 19-year-old agent could do.
Yeah, yeah.
So, my dad's thing was always, Barry signs you, you're going to be famous when you fire him.
Our last guest was at Monterey and found the Who so sort of overwhelmingly noisy and violent, she hid under the stage because she thought something terrible was going to Ellen Sander.
Well, I mean, the great thing about the Who at the Marquee, because we used to go in the back, so I'd come from school, put my blazer in my duffel bag, meet Barry at the office in Wardour Street, then we'd go into the back of the back door of the Who. Roger would be kind of had a screwdriver in his microphone, and they were doing their own tech. And Pete used to break probably 3 Rickenbackers a show. They weren't earning any money.
Just the 3.
And so after sound check, we all went to the pub, and because I was 15, everyone was standing outside the pub. So it was the Ship and the Intrepid Fox. And because they didn't like each other, you'd actually be with, Roger and John at one and Pete and Keith at the other. But we used to hang out with them before the gig, and I remember Kit Lambert saying, "Peter, could you not break quite so many guitars tonight?"
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these 3 EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
You know, we're really losing money on this. And then Pete broke three guitars that night. Just, had he not said anything, he probably would have broken one. But it was... It's. I mean, I saw The Who right through their career, and those marquee days were just so superior.
I bet.
Because it became pantomime.
Yeah.
Quite quickly, you know, when he had faux amplifiers and things.
Yes.
You know, when he smashed an amplifier and a guitar, they were real.
Yeah.
And on stage, so.
You are getting an extraordinary insight into the business from management, putting on gigs, all of those things. I mean, is that why you're so successful as a record man?
I teach...
As well as loving the music,
obviously. I teach A&R at Berklee College of Music. I'm a guest lecturer there, and I have been for 8 years. And before that, I taught at, you know, University of the Arts and London Metropolitan. All I ever wanted to be was either a record producer or an A&R man. I loved records. I loved the whole recording process. Huge fan of the Beach Boys, you know, that period and what the Beatles were doing. So I loved production. And we went to see the Byrds, I think, in 1965 or 66 at the Lyceum. And all my friends went, they were so terrible that night. Mm. They said, God, they're dreadful. You know, forget the Byrds. And I went, why? They said, they were terrible. And I went, so what? They make brilliant records.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would say at that point, you know, looking back, that was the key point when it wasn't about the live acts. And also, I'd seen the best live acts I was ever going to see. It was really about the recording process. Yeah. So that's what I wanted to be. But I happened to be good at business and money and negotiation. And so, and also, when I went into the record business, I thought to run a record company. I was looking at Chris Blackwell,
right.
Simon Draper, Ahmet Ertegun. They all made records.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you thought, well, to be a successful head of a record company, which, you know, is in the back of your head is maybe, if I make some great records, mm-hmm. I can run a record company. I didn't realize, you know, that you had to do all the other stuff. But as I did it, when I first started in publishing, in the first week I said to the, you know, the head of business affairs, give me a few contracts. And I took them home and I read them and I came back and asked questions. So I understood contracts from age 21. So it was that thing of...
Yeah. The round, yeah, the whole...
But, you know, A&R talent falls on very different people in different ways. I mean, everybody thinks they know what a hit record is. Very few people have the chance of hearing it in its raw state, whether that's live or a demo. Mm-hmm. But everyone thinks they know a hit, but, you know, as I always say, only some of us are right. I mean, a friend of mine, you know, from university days said, your job's easy. He said, when I hear a record on the radio, I know whether it's going to be a hit or not. I said, before it gets on the radio, exactly. There's an awful lot of filters. That's yes, all we've yeah, gone yeah. through.
Yes, yes.
But it's that thing of being able to see something in very, very raw material.
Mm. And so how do you teach A&R then?
Well, I start with saying I can't teach you A&R. It's a gift. A&R is a gift that is bestowed on people. It's a bit like voices. Mm. You know, voices. Rod Stewart has a voice. A Scottish person born in Crouch End has a voice, you know, like Sam Cooke. Yes. You know, why? Paul Carrack has a voice. You know, you have all these different things.
Yeah, yeah.
But whose it's bestowed on are all different people. Joe Cocker, you know, it's, you don't automatically, you know, look like you're going to get it. Van Morrison.
Yeah.
And A&R is the same as a gifted pianist or something like that. You just have that sixth sense of this is special.
Mm. Yes.
And so I tell them I can't teach that, but if you've got it, I can teach you how to use it. If you haven't got it, I can teach you to have a career. So that's how we do it. But we analyze songs, we analyze productions, you know, and I tell stories because, you know, I've made so many records.
Yeah.
You know, I've executive produced, which is kind of like A&Ring, you know, Enya's hits and Cher's and Rod Stewart's and, you know, quite a few people on the cause. So I've got involved in, so I can actually teach by example, saying this is how we did Believe by Cher, as opposed to the other teachers there kind of teaching theory.
Yeah.
So I you know, I teach the theory and then I give them a personal example and I say to them, have we got time for a story? And they all go, yes. So I just do stories. Let the other people do all the boring stuff.
Very good, very good. When did you first join Warners? What year did you first join Warners?
September the 20th, 71.
I love the September the 20th.
Well, that's a big day in your life.
So before that, you were in publishing. Were you in publishing?
No, that was publishing.
Right.
Which I didn't know. I mean, when I finished university, you know, when you're waiting for your grades, I thought, what do I want to do? And I thought, I either want to be a writer, I want to be in the music business, the film business, or the magazine business.
Right.
So I wrote letters to all the magazine, IPC and all these magazine places. I wrote letters to all the film companies. I wrote letters to all the record companies saying, you know, I've done this and I was social sec and da, da, da. And I got no replies from the film companies at all.
Mm-hmm.
I got a reply from Polydor to be a salesman in Birmingham.
Right.
And I kind of thought, you know, that's hardly going to be a career starter, is it? So I kind of turned that down. I got a refusal from Kinney, which was
the parent company,
the precursor of WEA.
Yes. Yeah.
So I got a refusal from that, which I've kept. I have that letter saying, I'm sorry, we don't have anything for you. And I got an interview at IPC for Honey, Petticoat and 19 as a writer.
Yeah, yeah.
So I went to work there for about 8 days.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my stories were, you know, it's very hard because you had to write down.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, for like for teenage audience. Girls yeah, on yeah. the tube. That's kind of from the audience for Honey and 19. So I wrote articles on keeping a big dog, Rastafarianism. And what's the other one? It was something. They were kind of nonsense things. You know, the Rasta thing was of the time.
Yeah.
But I sketched those out, and I noticed that everyone was a woman. You know, the editor was a woman, assistant editor was a woman, the features writers were all women, and I kind of thought this is a woman's world. A man's not going to work. This is 71.
Yes,
a man's not going to be able to work in this area. And then I got this thing from Warner Brothers Music, the publishing company, saying, we've got a job opening. Would you like to come for an interview? So I, you know, went home and I said to my dad, you know, what's publishing? I have no idea what this is.
Yeah.
So he explained it to me. And I went for the interview and they just got the Bob Dylan catalogue. And then the boss who was interviewing me said, we've just got the Bob Dylan catalogue from, you know, Leeds Music. And they've not sent us any titles, just first lines. And so I said, oh, show me the first lines. And I said, well, that's this, that's this. and then he hired me.
So fantastic.
Based around Bob Dylan subtitles.
Yes, brilliant. I started. But in those days, Kinney Warners was so small. We were in the same office building.
Right.
And then on my first day at work, the promotion guys at the record company, one of them was ill and one of them was away on holiday.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent me straight down to the record company as a promotion man who'd never promoted anything record-wise.
Yeah.
And so I was suddenly there and, yeah, my first day, I was kind of really nervous.
I'm going
to work for the first time. And I said to my dad, you know, I just hope I can do this. And he said, you know, most people in the music business are stupid, so you're not, so you'll do well. And I thought, I just thought, that's a dad to a son on his first day at work.
Yeah.
So I go to work, they send me down, and within an hour I'm in a promotion meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like probably 15 people in this meeting, artist relations, everyone's in this meeting. And they get to Riders on the Storm.
Right.
Just gone in the charts. So the head of promotion, just remain nameless, said, okay, the Doors in at number 20. We're going to fly them in. We're going to do Top of the Pops. We're going to do interviews and da, da, da. And I thought, no, Rob, you've been in the music business for an hour and a half. Like, shut up. And he carries on. And I just thought, this is so ridiculous. But shut up. And everyone looking at everyone's face and they're all listening. You know? And then I went, Dez, sorry.
Cat's out of the bag, yeah.
Yeah. The reason they got in the charts is Jim Morrison died.
Oh, for God's sake.
And he went, oh, shit, and hit his forehead. And I thought, Dad,
he's right.
I always thought, if I ever wrote a book, first chapter would be called Dad,
you're right.
That's fantastic.
And then in the first week, we went to pick up the Doors. They still brought them in.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, you want to come? It's on a bus. We're going to take a bus to Heathrow. So we took a London bus to Heathrow to pick them up. Because these were the days you had to do stuff like that. And it broke down just around about Chiswick House. And there's a wonderful photograph of me and Derek Taylor sitting on a bus with the Doors looking fed up. That was my first week at work.
That's fantastic.
So when people go about on the Doors, I get this picture out and go, yeah, that's me and the Doors. In 71.
Me and the Doors.
Like a dog without a bone and actor out of loan, Riders on the Storm.
When you started at Warners, what did the label mean to you? What did Warner Reprise mean to you as a fan?
Well, a lot of the records I'd played, you know, that I'd listened to, I'd asked for, were Warner Reprise. I mean, I remember having, going right back to Warner Brothers, of Kathy's Clown by the Everly Brothers, and I remember the red label with the arrows on it. But all through, like, Van Morrison, Joni Mitchell. So it was a label mostly, well, only for American acts. And I was heavily into American acts. So it was a label that I knew pretty well. And I was amazed when I took out, you know, when I took over the record label, is that they lost money from inception until I took over. And they'd had the Eagles' Greatest Hits and Fleetwood Mac Rumours, and still they managed to lose money.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wow. That is very hard.
And they never, believe. Ever...
Gosh.
They never made money. And that was, you know, the business thing. In 6 months, we turned a profit.
Mm.
And, in you know, when I left, we were, I think, per the size of our releases to our profits. It's not, they weren't the highest profits because companies were much bigger, but we were the best percentage profit to turnover. But that's just something. I always, David Geffen said to me once, he said, you know, I'm in the David Geffen business. The trouble with you is you're in the Warner business. And because I used to run it as if I owned it. So when I could, you know, by the time I was chairman, I could have a suite in a hotel and travel first class. I still travel first class. But I had a room because I just slept in it. I didn't do business or anything else. And I remember one of my staff who was traveling with me who had a suite. And I said, why do you need a suite? He said, well, because I can. And I just went, well, I can't do that. And I did actually run it as if I... So I paid attention to lots of things. Waiting times on cabs. You know,
yeah.
I suddenly went, no, we're not paying waiting time on cabs.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Keeping on the bottom line, basically.
Yeah, I mean, well, yes.
Yeah, and it was because... You know, it hurts if we lost any money over anything. Yeah.
Sure. And that was a very incredibly indulgent time for the music business as well.
Waiting time on cabs sounds kind of mean, but basically people in press and A&R and marketing were ordering a cab for like 12:30 and getting in it at 1:30.
Right.
Yeah. To go to a lunch, which then was an expense.
Yeah.
And it was just trying to think, you can have the cab, but you can't have an hour.
Well, 9 times out of 10, they could probably just walk around the corner to have lunch.
How dare you?
And then I can speak for Mark and Martin when I say that those labels, Warner and Reprise, were really important to us.
Yes. Mm.
So many of the artists that we worshipped. So, you know, we're doing a kind of Warner Reprise special to coincide with you being on the podcast. Okay. And, you know, I mean, when you think about Van Morrison, Joe, you think about Little Feet.
Well, for me, it's Live Dead.
Live Dead, well, of course, for you, Grateful Dead.
I mean, yeah, I bought that when it came, just after it came out.
Yeah.
And that was probably the first record I owned which had the Warner Brothers logo on the label. I just loved that record.
Yes.
And it was mysterious. As American, it was so far away and kind of strange.
It's so bloody awful.
Hang on, it's the second time. Gary Kent gives me a hard time.
That's very funny.
That's your lot, mate, as a deadhead, I'm sorry.
With the exception of maybe Uncle John's Band. And
we don't have time for a debate about the Grateful Dead.
Relative merits.
I'll tell you a quick story, though, is that there was this really attractive girl, and I asked her out, and I had Grateful Dead tickets because I was at Warner's. And she was a huge Grateful Dead, so we had these great tickets, and I was caught. And I was really keen. I was really keen on this girl. And we got there, and 3 hours, no, 2.5 hours into the gig, I said, I can't
stand this anymore.
I can't take any more of this. It's so dreary. And she said, it's brilliant, it's brilliant. So I said, well, I'm going to go. She said, well, I'm going to stay. And that was it. Wow.
Mark, have any of your relationships collapsed?
I never pushed them that far.
They played for 5 hours that night, and I just thought, God, 2 hours of my life I got back.
Martin, I mean, when you think about Warner Reprise, are there specific albums or moments or gigs?
Yes, there were. Well, certainly after the Gold Rush, that entire kind of era of music, partly because it felt, I don't know, I think American music at that point was incredibly seductive.
Yeah.
You know, I'd grown up with jazz musicians and skiffle and all of those things, and the Warners seemed to have some connection to black music, and they had a connection to a kind of intelligent end of certainly, you know, 69 to 74 or kind of Little Feet, that whole thing. It was one of those times where if it was on Warners, you could trust it. You could buy it and not be worried. I mean, you didn't like everything, but there was enough, you know, that was always a good guide.
Yes.
I had that with Elektra Records.
Yeah.
I bought Elektra Records because I had Paul Seymour, you know, The Doors, Rhinoceros. Yeah. And I remember the first time I met Jack Holtzman, I said, I used to buy Elektra Records just because it was on Elektra. Until one record. And then I went, that's it. It's over. I'm never going to buy Elektra Records without hearing it. And as Jack said, well, what was that? I said, The Whackers. You know The Whackers?
No,
we've got a couple of pieces on The Whackers.
Have we?
Yeah, I mean, can you describe what they sounded like? Were they like a power? Were they sort of power?
No, they were meant to be, hence the name. They were meant to be Beatlesque.
Beatlesque.
But they were actually monkey-esque. without the songs. So if you imagine a terrible songwriter writing songs with the Monkees, you've kind of got The Whackers. And I was so personally offended that I'd paid this money. I bought it from Imhoff's in Tottenham Court Road. Yeah. I don't know her name, but I don't think she wants me around.
the first act you personally signed as an A&R man?
My first signing in publishing was Johnny Bristol.
Oh, right, yeah.
Hang on in there, baby.
Hang on in there, baby, yes. Yeah. Hang on in there, baby. Went to number two.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Warner Brothers Music was the number 11 publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And within 2 years, we were number one.
Wow.
But that was the first one I signed. But the great thing about Johnny Bristol is he had a lawyer called Lee Phillips. And Lee Phillips was Joni Mitchell, Neil Young. And when I took over the publishing company, it was a week before my 24th birthday. Mm-hmm. So I'm 24, and all the American lawyers took away all their acts because they went, as a kid running a company, we're going to go to a proper publishing company, except for Lee Phillips. So he kept Joni and Neil with me, and he said, you know, I've got this new artist, Johnny Bristol. So signed Johnny Bristol, and that was a hit. And I was in America, and he said, I've got this new kid, and we're going to sign to Warner Brothers Records. You know, do you want to hear some demos? Mm. And it was Prince. So when he was 17, wow. He played me Prince demos.
Fantastic.
That became his first album.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went, I love this.
Yeah.
So I signed Prince, like, on the spot, as Warner's were still negotiating. So we had Prince at the same time
yes.
as the record company.
Wow.
Then I watched the record company fail to break him.
Right.
Right.
Which is when we do it. You know, when I took over... And it was Purple Rain, and we broke When Doves Cry. And the follow-up was Let's Go Crazy. And I went, no, no, not in England.
Mm-hmm.
1999.
Yes.
Backed with Little Red Corvette. And they went, what are you talking about? I said, I want to prove a point. They will always hit records.
Yeah.
And I've got to know that I can make them hit records.
Right.
And so that was a double A side. I think went to number two.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And that, but only existed in the UK. Is it because? I mean, I did the same thing with Madonna. We put out "Get Into the Groove," which the only place it came out as an A side was in the UK.
Yeah,
because I think it was Angel was the record they told us to play.
So it's actually a hit. She was a hit here before she was a hit in America. Is that right?
Well, they sent her. They said, you know, England's got no music, just image, and we've got an artist that is just image.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a disco singer. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to send her to England because we don't know what to do with her. And I remember a very high-ranking executive at Warner Brothers America said, I just wish we had Cyndi Lauper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he said, no, but you see what you can do with Madonna. So she kind of lived in the press office in the UK.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a good Madonna story at the beginning. We took her out for dinner. She'd had a single just before I got there called Everybody, which stiffed.
Mm-hmm.
And she was signed on a 12-inch deal by Seymour Stein for Sire. And then they changed that into an album deal a bit later on. And so we took her out to dinner. And a couple of things happened. That day, she had a press thing from The Face, The Daily Express, all this stuff she had to do. And she didn't show up for it.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, what verb can I use? She was partying with Ranking Roger of the Beat, who she'd met the night before.
Right.
Until, you know, right the way through the press day. And and then we took her to dinner that night, and I said, look, Madonna, you've got to... And it was weird saying the word Madonna back then.
Yes, yes.
You know, when you're talking to someone... Yes. Instead of, like, you know, hey, Barney, it was like, hey, Madonna. It was strange saying those words.
Yeah.
But I said to her, you know, that's really, we're going out on a limb here. These people, and she said, you know what? Every unknown does an interview with these people. And I didn't. And now remember, I didn't when I'm the biggest actor in the world. And I'm looking at this girl that had one record out that stiff. And she's saying, when I'm the biggest fan, I'm rolling my eyes thinking, oh, my God. And I look back at it when she was the biggest act in the world. And I think, did she know? I mean, I felt that she knew. It was very weird that she always knew.
What year was this? 81?
83.
83, yeah.
I was remember being in a demo studio around 82, 83. And this guy, one of John Rocker from Freeze, he was in the studio. He said, have you heard of this woman called Madonna? She can do everything. She can dance, she can sing, she can do the lot. And
she can part
and I've never long. Heard of her. That's the very first time I heard her name mentioned. And it was really interesting. This guy was, you know, just
so I actually interviewed her at Warner's when it may have been the second time she came over. Yeah. And I did find her self belief terrifying. Yeah. Actually.
It was.
Yeah.
Well, I have a theory about every artist changes from, you know, before success. They can be the nicest person in the world, but success will change them.
Yeah, yeah.
One way or another, usually not for the best, but they become different people. And I've seen it so many times. And I always say, there's one person that didn't change, was Madonna.
Yeah.
And he went, oh, really? And she stayed. I said, she was always a nightmare. So when she was the biggest act in the world, she was still a nightmare.
Yes.
So she's the only one that had a level... You know, everyone else has a graph getting more and more difficult. She was difficult from the get-go.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Extraordinary.
You were in the music business for a long time. You saw all the various changes. I mean, how did you feel? I mean, say going from... through the end of the 70s, the 80s and the 90s, how did you sort of feel the music business changed? And did it change for the better or for the worse? Or
That's a bit metaphysical, really.
Sorry. I do apologise.
And it changed.
Yes.
It also depends on what point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, at the moment, the record industry makes more money than it's ever made in its life.
Extraordinarily, after a period when it was really...
Everyone thought it was over.
Yeah. Yeah.
And those people, that, you know, like Len Blavatnik, who made decisions to get involved in it, you know, have payday. So the record industry, you know, went from making a little bit of money to making a lot of money to making even more with CDs.
Right.
And then... completely missed the boat with
downloads.
Yeah.
We got this marvellous interview with Sky Solomon, who ran Tower Records from 1994.
Russ Solomon.
And he's saying downloads will never catch on. No one will want to listen to music on their computers. And it's just marvellous reading this now. It's just, and then Tower went bust in 2004, you know, so it was.
I was on the, you know, chairman of BPI, so I was on the IFPI.
Right.
And I remember there was like a Sean Fanning meeting about, you know, the devil, this guy. And they were going to sue him here and sue him there. And I went, I think you're all mad. I think we should be hiring him. Mm. He saw a business we didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the point. But they were always, they didn't believe in CDs.
No.
It's like... It's a resistance. You know, they really believed in cassettes, which is probably the worst the worst thing that ever happened to the music business. And they all believed in cassettes because they were cheap.
Until people started taping their stuff on cassettes, and home taping is killing music.
I was chairman of the BPI during that thing. And so, but it was... So financially, it's had its up. It got more and more profitable, and then it had a dip, and then it came back more profitable than ever. For the big labels, because basically they're turning over a billion songs. You know, one label, Universal, I think, has a billion songs, are selling every single day. Now, minuscule amounts of money,
but
selling every hour of every day in every country.
It's extraordinary.
It wasn't, let's wait for the record store to open.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, so every minute there's someone downloading, streaming something. So the profits with no A&R, no marketing.
Right.
Astronomical.
Yeah.
And a load of your catalogue with no upfront cost to it.
So you can look at it that way, and then you look at it the artist way.
Yeah.
And you see, and you know, when I was buying records or obtaining records, it was, you know, there was one TV in the house and a Dansette record player in your bedroom. And, you know, you either watch TV that your parents decided on, or you went to your room and played a record, or you went to your friend's house and played records. There was no other. So music became everything.
Yeah.
And then bit by bit, it's become a strand.
Yes.
Of, you know, a completely multidimensional empire of what you can do with your time.
Yeah.
And, you know, also music's how you judge people.
Yes.
I used to go to girls' flats and things when I was sort of dating. And I'd go straight to the
record
collection and go...
Not dating her. Too many grateful Demerits. Too many grateful Demerits.
No, Julia, what was her name? There was an artist on Virgin called...
Julia, I know who you mean, yes. And Julia Fordham.
Julia Fordham. And if I saw a Julia Fordham...
You were out of there.
I was out of there.
Oh,
if I saw an Otis Redding record, if I saw Otis Blue there, I think this is a keeper.
Proposed on the spot.
This is a keeper,
You mentioned Rod Stewart earlier, Rob, and I just wanted to ask you about the story of Downtown Train.
Right.
Yes.
Well, it's when I took over Warner's, the day I took over, the second day of my reign at Warner's as the chair, Baby Jane went to number one.
Mm-hmm.
Had nothing to do with me. But it was kind of like a sign. They hadn't had a number one in years. And then suddenly there's this number one. And so Rod Stewart was back on it, selling lots of records. And then we had year two, year three, year four. And he just made all those, forgettable AOR records that sold in America, in Europe, not just the UK. The people didn't really buy his records anymore. I had a meeting with him and his manager saying, what's going on in the UK? Why isn't Rod... So, I'm slightly Asperger's when it comes to... I can lie about anything,
mm-hmm.
but I can't lie about music. So if someone's asked me a musical question, whether it's, what do you think of the record or whatever, and I said, well, basically, Rod is a good singer of mediocre songs
yes.
and a great singer of great songs.
Yeah, yeah.
And unfortunately, the last couple of albums have been mediocre songs. And... First of all, the manager couldn't believe I just said that. and he, with Rod in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rod said, so you can find me a great song, and I said, in a second. And he said, okay, my house in Epping, Saturday, Saturday lunchtime, you come over. Epping from London is a schlock. I just had an argument with everything that was going on because I love Tom Waits. I've got some Tom Waits stories as well. I love Tom Waits.
We all love Tom.
And they used to do Downtown Train in the act.
Right.
And they demoed it. And I said, oh, this is a single. And they went, you don't tell us what singles we can do. I said, no, but, it's not like I came up with the idea. You came up with the idea. And they said, well, we're not doing it. So I thought, so when I was trying to think of a great song, I thought, Downtown Train, that's a great song. It was right in my front of my brain. And also, I knew Rod a little bit,
mm-hmm.
I sort of met him a few times with the faces and stuff. And I knew he had the concentration of of a rock star, let's put it that way. So I made a cassette and I put Downtown Train on it three times. And I went over to the house and then... His son came down with a boombox,
mm-hmm.
and I slotted in the cassette, and I played Downtown Train, and I said, "Don't say anything." And I played it, and then it came on again, and then I said, "Don't say anything." and the third time it played, he went, "I love it. I absolutely love it." And his son, who was a teenager at the time, said, "Dad, why does he sing so bad?" And I went, that's my point. Most people can't stand Tom Waits' singing voice. Sure. I mean, I love it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I got why he's not, a huge seller. And I said, so that song with you singing it suddenly. So he says, okay, I'll do it. So I rein in Trevor Horn,
mm-hmm.
and Trevor goes and does a sort of a backing track with Rod doing it. And I'm thinking, oh, this is good. This could be something. And then I'm somewhere out of London. I get a phone call from Lenny Wanaker, who has, I've never seen him say a harsh word to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
He is, that avuncular, easygoing. He calls me up. He's so angry. And he goes, I hear you're making a record with Rod Stewart. And I said, well, yeah. He said, what do you mean, well, yeah? He said, it's not your artist. You are the distribution of Warner Brothers Records. And how dare you take an A&R decision on one of our artists without talking to us?
Wow.
So I kind of thought, well, you're right, because I'd be the same.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I said, and he said, so what are you going to do? I said, if you don't want it and it's finished, we'll take the cost. We'll eat the cost.
Sure.
So he kind of reluctantly agreed. And I put the phone down, the phone rings, and it's Trevor Horn. He said, I've been thinking about this track. It needs an orchestra.
Just after you said you absorbed the cost.
Yeah, it needs an orchestra. And I thought, oh, God. And I said, do you mean strings? He said, no, it needs an orchestra. So I just went in for a penny, in for a pound. So I said, okay. So he puts an orchestra on it. And they still haven't done final vocals. Rod's gone back to LA. Trevor flies out to do the vocal. He rings me up and he said, when Rod's warmed up his voice, the whole track is in the wrong key.
Oh,
so Christ. He's now a semitone different from this. So I'm thinking, oh, God, this is, you know, this is the terrible situation. So then I said, what can you do? And he said, look, I'm talking to all kind of technicians here. So then he called back and he said, like, we can move it up a semitone without ruining the strings. So they did.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Rod did it in his proper key and everybody loved it. And it kind of put Rod back. He was on the cover of Rolling Stone after it, which he hadn't been on for years.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, yeah.
Suddenly he was cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that the Tom Waits effect.
And that leads me to a Tom Waits story, but I'm not sure we got time.
Well, I see you tonight on a downtown train. Every night is just the same on a downtown train.
I do have to ask you about the whole debacle around Robert Morgado and Doug Morris. Tell us the story of how you came within a whisker of becoming head of Warner.
I was the head of Warner.
You were for 24 hours.
For 24 hours.
The global head of Warner Brothers.
I was, yeah. And the job, it was a job I always wanted. I mean, I love Warner Brothers. I love what they meant, which was an artist haven.
Yes.
And very A&R led.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, CBS Sony was business affairs led, you know, for quite cold decisions. It was much warmer at Warner Brothers.
Mm.
And then Mo Austin was this, you know, this great figure that ran it. And he and Bob Morgado, who was overseeing the music division, fell out. I think Warner's weren't doing it quite as well as he wanted. They weren't, Mo, I think, was too powerful. And so they fell out and Mo was gone and they had to replace him. And they offered me the job, and which I said yes to, and flew out to LA and met a few people. David Geffen had a house in the Bird Streets in West Hollywood. And he said, you know, if you need a house, there's a house here straight away so you can, you know, get started. So it was all kind of looking good. And then Bob Morgado said, I've just got to, you know, sort out a few bits of local politics. So I said, fine, let me know when you need me. And he said, because I want you to do a series of press conferences in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, fine, you know, whenever you need me. And I was at the ASCAP Awards, I think, in London. And I got back at 1 o'clock. I got a phone call from Bob Morgado. He said, we need you here tomorrow morning. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. And he said, because we're going to announce it. So we're doing the press thing, we're going to announce it. So I didn't really go to bed. I had to find a hotel room,
mm-hmm.
which Rod Stewart's manager, you know, because I couldn't get a hotel room in New York. And he said, I've got a suite at the Carlisle, I'm not going to use, you have that. So I had a hotel, and then I had to get the Concorde.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the first Concorde out, you know, and I'm flying out, and I said, oh, my goodness, to my now wife. And I said, what is going on? She said, it's your destiny. And so I got on this plane thing, and it's the job, the one job I've always mm-hmm. wanted, to run Warner Brothers Records properly from America. So I get to the hotel, and I get a phone call from Morgado's assistant saying, Bob's got to deal with a few things. Can you just wait in the hotel room?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm waiting in the hotel room, and then I don't hear. So we're going from like 9 o'clock New York time, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. David Geffen rings me and said, what's going on? I said, I'm waiting in this room. I don't know what's going on. He said, I hear you're out. You know, I'm preparing for a press conference, so this is going to really, you know, trust Geffen to know before anyone else. He's not even, I think even there, it's like 5 o'clock in the morning or something. Yeah. Anyway, he just started DreamWorks. And he said, look, whatever happens, there's a job for you at DreamWorks. And he said, they hadn't opened yet.
Right.
And he said, so don't get upset. You've got a job here. And they were all over the news when it was launched. So I kind of thought, well, that's nice, but I don't know what's going on. So after about 1 o'clock, I called Magala's office and he said, I'm in a bit of a difficult situation. Doug Morris says it's him or you. You know, and Doug Morris at that time was going to be head of the music division. And he said, Doug says it's him or you. And we can't, and I said, well, you can't give in to that. You immediately, weakened your whole position. I said, I know I've got an interest in this, but as an advisor to you, when someone says it's him or, it's him or me, against your decision, you can't let them win. And he said, well, I've got to, and, I'm really sorry.
Wow.
And so I'm just left at the Carlisle with a job that I thought I'd had. And, they'd made arrangements for what happened in the UK.
Yeah.
All this had gone on in 24 hours.
It's an astonishing story.
And, And I've got to say, I think I'd have had a nervous breakdown, other than the fact that David Geffen said, because that was the coolest label that was going to be, after Asylum and everything else and Geffen Records. Mm-hmm. I think if I'd been left that, and then I came back and they said, Rob, of course you've got your old job. And so I rang David and thanked him and said, look. And he said, well, why wouldn't you leave? And I said, my staff and my artists. Mm. By that time I had Enya and, lots of different Simply Red. We had lots of things that we were doing well with. And I said, I can't leave them.
No.
And that kind of made my relationship with David not quite as good as it used to be. But that situation.
I remember that great big Vanity Fair story about this whole drama.
I had a gay friend because I remember I had Brad Pitt on the cover, and then there was the Brad Pitt sort of photo splash where he was kind of in nothing but a pair of shorts, and a gay friend then said to I've got the Vanity Fair, and I kind of rang him a couple of days later and I said, well, what do you think? And he said, I can't get past the Brad Pitt picture.
He hadn't even read the story. No. You were quoted. No. That's fantastic.
Oh, dear.
That is absolutely brilliant. We're going to have you back for a kind of part two, because we don't have that much more time. We need to
move on to
the audio interview.
In fact, it's quite a good way of ending this part is on the disaster of your 24-hour appointment as...
Yes.
Yeah, when people say, you never were head of Warner Brothers, I said, yes, I was. 24 hours.
Well, your Warner's career did officially end in 1998, of course, which was, three or so years later.
Yeah.
There's obviously more to talk about after that.
It ended with the biggest record of my career.
Leave that bit out. Tell us about it.
Share Believe.
Shares Believe.
Yeah. Well, the extraordinary story of creation of Believe is unbelievable.
Yes.
It's kind of... Yeah, there's quite a few things we're missing out.
I know, I'm sorry about that. Yeah. Tell us about Cher. Tell us about that record. Because it was a huge record.
Cher's manager I'd known, he was a friend of my brother's, and he was just the most wonderful person. And so he rings me and said, I can't get arrested. And we've been dropped by Geffen. I can't get arrested in the States. And if anyone can make a hit record with it, it's you. And, Flattery will get you everywhere. So so we talked a deal and I signed Cher to the UK company. And I thought, I can make hits with Cher, which I did. I got Trevor Horn in because we just done the Rod Stewart stuff. And so I got Trevor Horn to do the record. And we made a fantastic record. And I don't know if you know, but on that record is a prefab Sprout song.
Oh, I didn't know that. Which one?
The Gunman.
Okay.
And I absolutely... It was a demo at the time from Paddy. I love Paddy McAloon. As a creative talent, as a human being, he's one of the best people I've ever met. And I just kind of thought it would be great to share a Paddy McAloon song. And so it's the song she hates more than anything, I think. It's the track she hates more. But it's wonderful. And we did this, and, you know, I Walking in Memphis was a great song and hadn't been a hit.
Yeah.
So I kind of heard her singing that. And then I had another track called One by One. So we made this record, which is called It's a Man's World, because we did James Brown, because I always thought how great to have that lyric sung by a woman, you know, by a strong woman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was the album. And we had two top 10 singles. The album did well, but nothing really to write home about. And then I had a meeting with Cher and Billy Samuth, her manager, who we call Bumper. And I said to her, all my gay male friends, of which I have a lot, love you. They've never mentioned your music once, but they love you. Why don't we make a record for them?
Right.
So, you know, because... And she said, what do you mean? A dance record? I said, yeah, a high-energy record. And, you know, just something that they can go, I love her and I love this, that record. And she said, I'm not making a dance record. I tried that in the disco time, and it was a disaster. Right. I'm not making a dance record. So I kind of knew I was right. And so I kept on and kept on. And then she, you know, we had phone calls and stuff. And she said, if you're going to carry on like this, I'm not talking to you. And she didn't talk to me for 3 months. And then she said, you know, I said, can we meet? And she was in LA, I was in London, so we decided to meet in New York. So I get to New York, and in the hotel, I've got a message from the desk going, from Cher, I'm not coming, I'm not making a dance record. So I'm thinking, great. And so I went and met with Junior Vasquez and Todd Terry, and I went to Tower Records, and I bought Cher Records. And I said, work out her key.
Yes.
And then write me some hits. And so... Todd Terry did a great track.
Right.
Junior Vasquez did something. And then she heard I was making the record. And at the same time, I bet you're glad you asked for this story. Aren't you? At the same time, I used to love hanging out in the A&R department. My office was on its own floor. But every time I wanted to hang out, the phone would ring or my fabulous assistant would say, you've still got to do this, this and this. I never got past her desk. And so this day I walked past the desk and went downstairs to the A&R department, and Steve Allen, my friend down there, had his door open, and there was a songwriter called Brian Higgins sitting there like this, sort of coyly in the corner. Steve was on the phone. And I, you know, I'd always had a rule, you never take a phone call unless it's from an artist. And he was on the phone call just like, and I just thought, no, this is terrible. So I said, Brian, how are you? And Brian had written for like Danny Minogue or something. And I just felt sorry for him. So I'm making a record with Cher. You know, have you got anything? So he said, I've got loads. And I went, I don't want loads. Give me two. So he turns up the next day with a DAT, which, you know, you can't play in your car. I had a DAT machine in my office. And is there a voice comes in and say, that is a digital audio tape, which was... yeah, and...
That's the future of recording.
And so I had a machine in my house, and on it was 16 tracks. And I went, oh, please. You know, I asked for two, I get 16, typical. So I completely forget about it. I take it home, and then one day I come home, and my wife is out, and it was a really hot summer's day. So I went up and laid on the bed, and I thought, well, I can listen to something. Now, the thing about DAT is you can't fast forward, and you can't pick tracks like a CD. So I put the DAT on, and the first track happened, the second track, they were terrible. And they were a minute long. And I thought, because it's so weird, a minute long, but it made it easy. So get to track 9, it's a track called Believe. And it's the chorus of Believe, which we all know. I thought, God, I love this. And then track 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, rubbish. And so I go back and I ring him up and I said, I really like this song, Believe, but it's just a chorus. And he said, well, I kind of figure if you don't like the chorus, what's the point of finishing the song? And I went, and this is a person who's sort of grown up with Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell. And I'm thinking, please, you know, where is it? What am I doing? So I said, well, finish the song. He said, yeah, I'll finish the song. And he finished the song. It was terrible. And I went, Brian, you've written this hit chorus and then this terrible verse and middle eight. And he said, well, you know, I'll give it another go. I said, no, you've had your chance. You know, I'm not that person anymore. You've had your chance. So I was working with a guy, a writer, producer, manager called Brian Rawling. And we were doing a song that he'd written for the Cher thing or sent me for Cher. And I said, oh, have you got, you know, can you finish this off? You know, your writer's finished this off. So then they came back with a terrible verse, terrible middle eight, and a great bridge to the chorus, which is the famous auto-tune part.
I've got two pieces.
I've still got no verse, and I've got no middle eight.
And no buy-in from the artist at this point.
Yeah, the artist doesn't want
to do it. The artist is not really talking to me.
It's really going well.
She's not making it. But, you know, I know I've got, like, the bones of a hit. So I say to Brian, you know, what is wrong? I'm giving you a hit chorus. Why can't you write a verse? And I said, no, you've had your chance. He said, well, I've got other writers. I said, okay. That's it. You can get some other writers on it. And then they wrote the verse. And I said, great, I really love the verse. The middle eight still sucks. And he said, oh, Rob, please give us a break. I mean, it's a great song. And I said, there is. You know, it's just. And so I said, okay. No matter how hard I try, you keep pushing me aside and I can't break through. There's no talking to you. And I sent it to Cher. I said, you know, you didn't think there were any songs in dance music. Well, listen to this. And I've got to say why I love Cher, and I do love Cher, is a lot of people, to make a point, someone who's like an icon like Cher, would have said, I hate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even if they didn't. Yeah.
Even if they didn't. She came back and said, I absolutely love it. She said, what do you want me to do? And I said, sing the fucking vocal. And so she flew over and she did it. And in the morning she got up to do the vocal. Oh, no, after she'd done the vocal. And Roachford was on This Morning, or morning TV. And he had a vocoder on his voice. And she went, I love this. So he went to the studio and she went, I want it to sound like Roachford. And they said, well, that's a vocoder. And we don't have one. He said, but I can give you an approximation. And he turns up the auto-tune to 10.
Yes.
To show what an auto-tune can do.
Yeah, yeah.
And she went, I love it. And he went, no, I'm only just showing you what he said, no, I love it. So I get a phone call saying that she's got this thing on her voice. And so I came down and I said, Cher, you know, your signature is your voice. Can we just dial it back again? And she said, anyone touches that over my dead body. And so someone was writing a book about number one records. And they said, so I'm writing this thing about how you put the auto-tune on. And I said, I got to say, I created the song like Frankenstein, but I did not do the auto-tune. That was completely Cher. So it was, I rang Cher when it was number one. And, you know, I was the little boy watching Ready, Steady, Go.
Yeah, absolutely.
15-year-old watching Ready, Steady, Go and thinking, I Got You, Babe was the best record I've ever heard.
Yeah.
And I'm this little boy waiting for him to pick up the phone. She's thrilled. Then I called Brian to tell him we're number one. And he went, that's fantastic. And he screamed, whooping. And I said, and the middle eight still sucks.
That's a great story.
That's fantastic.
It's a shaggy dog story.
If all the things that could have rung, the phone could have rung, you know, which it always did. Or my assistant said, you've still got reply to so-and-so.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have gone downstairs.
Yeah.
If Steve hadn't picked up the phone, he'd been the door closed meeting, I wouldn't have seen Brian Higgins.
Yeah.
If my wife hadn't gone out that evening, I wouldn't have listened to that.
Yeah.
And the whole trajectory of popular music would be different.
I saw Cher the other day, and she said Kanye West came up to her, and he said, how does it feel creating a whole, genre of music? Because hip-hop embraced auto-tune.
To a ridiculous degree. To a very bad extent.
Oh, no, a very bad extent.
Yes.
But and also, so did, like, pop singers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in the true sense of just being able to put it in tune.
Yeah.
But men's every vocal sounds.
I love the fact that she was alert enough to what was happening with the sound of her voice with this machinery to instantly say, this is really interesting. I mean, that's an artist. That's a creative decision of hers.
She's the greatest. I mean, she's funny.
I'm so glad you say that, because I've always adored her from a long way away. And
are you gay?
No. Should I be?
Yeah,
we are on
the share scale.
We are now, by
you officially are now.
Okay, yes, all right. Exactly. I can take that.
I get my friends now, my gay friends. If I go somewhere and there's lots of gay people, they go, this is Rob. He made Believe. And it's like, I'm suddenly like this superpower.
I remember reading Robbie Fulks, who's an alt-country singer, was in travelling endlessly in a van with his band. And that came on, and everyone was going, oh, turn that off. And he said, no, this is a great, great song. And they all said, really? So he put it in the set that night, and then they kept doing it. And everyone came to realise
it was a song.
But kind of country-esque.
Except for the middle eight.
Except for the middle eight. I dropped that.
If you listen to that record again, you'll see what I mean.
When we finished this, we must have listened to
it basically just repeats a line, and, it's dreadful. But it's surrounded by brilliance, so we get away with it.
So how many writers were credited in the end?
Six.
Wow.
2+2+2.
Yeah. And all different percentages?
It won the... it was an argument about percentages. But I said Brian Higgins has got to get 50%.
Right.
Because of the chorus.
He started the whole Genesis.
Yeah.
So it was that thing. There was a bit of argument from the others, but, in the end... They all made millions.
Yes.
Except me.
Clark or Alan Freed sense, your name should be on the track.
Yeah, should really.
Well, Pete Waterman. Because Pete, Stock and Aitken wrote the song.
Yeah, and he always put his name on it, yeah.
Yeah, but I get it, because he directed them.
It wouldn't have happened without him.
He orchestrated their work, and that's kind of what I did, but... Yeah. I wasn't a producer. I was the head of a record company, and it was not, certainly not what I wanted to do.
No.
But I kind of felt when they won song, they all went up. And I got asked up as well. But when I was going, this is so-and-so, meet Brian Higgins, and so, it's like, they never met.
That's so funny.
And I think it's the only song I've Frankenstein in my career.
Yeah, that's great.
That's fantastic. It's brilliant. Thanks for talking to us about your amazing career, Rob. It's really, really been fascinating. And I know we could talk for another 2-3 hours, but we do have to move on.
We've got to move on.
The week's new audio interview. What is it, Mark?
Yeah, it's Leon Russell being interviewed by Andy Gill in 1998. It's terrific. It's about an hour long, but he goes right back to backing Jerry Lee Lewis in Oklahoma, moving to Los Angeles, becoming one of what he in fact says they were never called at the time, and he rightly so, the Wrecking Crew, the piano player with the Wrecking Crew, playing lots of Phil Spector sessions, playing on Birds' Mr. Tambourine Man, which of course the Birds themselves didn't play on, except for Roger McGuinn, I think.
Which ties in with what you were saying earlier, Rob, about the Birds on
live
stage
I've been for a while in the Shindig House Band, Jack Good, who I will talk about a little bit later as well. Delaney and Bonnie, Denny Cordell coming out, meeting Joe Cocker, starting the idea of Shelter Records. This is in the first clip, which is about putting together Mad Dogs and Englishmen for Joe Cocker.
Well, it worked out that Joe had fired the Grease Band. He had 50 shows booked in the United States, and he was going to cancel them. but he had fired his band for some reason. And the musicians' union told him that if he didn't play those shows, they weren't going to let him work in the United States again. So he was kind of up against the wall a very short amount of time, 4 or 5 days before the first show. So he asked me, actually Denny asked me, could I put something together so he could make those dates. So I just trying to think of something that could be done rapidly. I just sat there and started dictating what it should be, what the band should be. We should get a film crew, get news crews, and get a plane. And so somebody was writing it all down. A couple of days later, all that stuff was there. And so it was interesting and worked well.
Yeah, it's good.
Once while traveling across the sky, this lovely planet's called mine.
So you've got to put a band together in 5 days, and you just complicate it enormously by adding a film crew.
It's extraordinary. Have you seen the film?
Yeah, it's recently.
I mean, I love that album. I mean, it's just absolutely one of my favourites. And but it's very, you know, you can see Joe Cocker's in a really unhappy situation, and him descending into what became basically 5 years of alcoholic gloom. Sort of dragged himself out of it. Then he talks more about Shelter Records, about his old Tulsa buddy J.J. Cale, what he calls the troubled soul of Willis Allen Ramsey. Recording Freddie King, the second time I saw Leon Russell, Freddie King was the support band at Rainbow, I guess, 72, 73. Then his first two solo albums, the first one with a very starry cast, recorded at Olympic here, Glyn Johns, brought in George Harrison, Ringo Starr.
Basically the Beatles and the Stones.
Basically. And he talks about writing songs and about A Song For You and The Masquerade becoming standards. This is his next clip. This is about A Song For You and Ray Charles.
At a certain period of time, I attempted to write standards. I was fascinated. There was a guy that played with Tower of Power, played the baritone sax, Doc. He said to me, I don't know how you do it. He said, I've had 12 number one records and nobody ever cuts my songs. He said, you have all these records out and hundreds of people cut your songs. How do you do that? So, I never really thought of it to that extent. But in a case of Song For You, I was trying to write a song that Ray Charles and Frank Sinatra both could sing, a blues song that had qualities that, that a standard lounge singer could sing. And in fact, my publishing guy took that to Ray Charles before my record came out, and his response was that he didn't like to do songs by people that sounded like him because he didn't want to be accused of stealing. So I was really pleased that he cut it. It was about 23 years later he cut it on that album and had a hit with it.
I've been so many places in my life and time, I've sung a lot of songs, I've made some bad rhymes.
That reminds me of Randy Newman's Lonely at the Top, which he wrote for Frank Sinatra.
And it's
still, God, if Frank Sinatra really had a sense of humour, that would have been one hell of a record.
It really would. I should mention that the reason we've added this is because there's a new biography of Leon, probably the first biography of Leon Russell, coming out next week by Bill Yanovitz, who was the lead singer of Buffalo Tom, and it's called The Master of Space and Time's Journey Through Rock and Roll History. And you've read some of it, haven't you?
I've got about a third of the way through. But really interesting, actually. Yeah,
it's a fascinating story.
To be a teenager and playing in Jerry Lee Lewis's band, for one thing.
At 14.
Also how he was a huge stage act in America in the early 70s, playing big, big audiences, and then his career just cratered more or less overnight. Mm. Then he did some interesting stuff. He talks about it, doing that really wonderful album with Willie Nelson, where he's playing on a Yamaha CP70 electric grand, which is the most distinctive piano noise on earth. everyone hates it. And he makes it sound and it works beautifully. And he also talks about the concert for Bangladesh that he was very involved in putting together, you know, with the church.
Did Leon mean anything to you, Rob?
I loved him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just loved those, I mean, Tightrope. I mean, just song after song.
Yeah, yeah.
Me and Baby Jane.
Delta Lady, I mean, which was a hit for Joe Cocker.
Yeah, I prefer the ballads.
You did.
Manhattan Island Serenade is sensational, I think.
Interesting singing voice. I mean, actually, closer to Dr. John than anyone else.
I love Dr. John.
Well, so as do we.
I think he was clearly influenced by Dr. John.
I guess he probably didn't have naturally a good singing voice. So he had
compared
to
Mac Rabanack, the voice was not
but also
a particularly strong voice.
He had to strangle this in order to give himself a sound that probably if he sung in his natural voice, it probably wouldn't sound that interesting. Mm. Anyway, I was a big, big fan. Loved what he did with Mad Dogs and Englishmen. Love his first two solo albums. Actually, his first three. Carney is a really good record.
Carney, I love.
Yeah. I mean, the story of the Mad Dogs tour is hair raising. The one bit of the book I have read because it was excerpted in Mojo is Bill Janowitz's account of the Mad Dogs tour, and it is just like breathtaking. How they got it together?
I know. Mike John, one of our writers, who wrote for the New York Times. He told me that Mad Dogs at the Fillmore East was the best show he's ever seen in his life. And this is a guy who's seen everyone, you know.
Yeah.
Is that where they recorded the...
Yeah, that's where the album's recorded, I think, yeah.
I mean, it's clearly chaotic, but in the spirit of those times, it somehow worked, didn't it? Like a lot of sort of things that happened at festivals, live events, where you just think, this is insane. Everyone's drug crazed, sleeping with each other. But it worked.
Still made it.
Yes.
The band I saw at the Albert Hall was essentially a chunk of the Mad Dogs band, he kind of kept together.
And, of course, a huge influence on Elton John, which is why.
Very big influence.
Who did then sort of come back to Leon's, well, I'm not going to say rescue, but I think he wanted to pay tribute to Leon, didn't he? So after this interview was recorded with Andy Gill from 1998, some years after that, Leon and Elton did an album together, which I don't know very well, but I remember seeing the pictures of Leon at that point looked like something out of Lord of the Rings.
Well, he always did.
We just didn't know Lord of the Rings.
A knight in white sense.
He had grey hair when I saw him in 71.
Yeah, right. With the white hair was tremendous, wasn't it?
It really was.
Fabulous.
It was a look. It was extraordinary.
Yeah,
very pleased to listen to that interview and hear all this stuff.
There's lots of interesting stuff.
And so far, the book's very good.
Is it? Good, good. Yeah. Excellent, great. So, what have we got time for? We do need to pay tribute to some fallen heroes.
Should we do that first?
I mean, how much time, Jasper, realistically, have we got? Minus 20 minutes.
Minus 20 minutes.
Okay, so let's use those minus 20 minutes. So we did lose Wayne Shorter last week, and I would ask you guys just to say something about this extraordinary saxophonist and the co-founder of Weather Report.
Sure. I mean, for me, it was those early Electric Miles albums, you know, In a Silent Way, Bitches Brew, which I just think of just fantastic records. And then he joins Weather Report, and I was anti-jazz rock at that time because I'd been put off by the Mahavishnu Orchestra, who I briefly loved and then decided I absolutely despised them.
And drugs wore off, didn't they?
That trip they've been on.
4 years later. He's very interesting. I mean, Richard Williams quoted Wayne Shorter telling Richard that he felt himself disappearing in Weather Report. Mm. And he did, because the first two, three albums, he is one of the most interesting solo voices. About four or five albums in, it's almost like he's not there.
Mm. Mm.
Very, very, it's very strange. And yet he sort of accepted it. First of all, one thing, he's earning more money than he ever earned in his life. I mean, for a jazz musician, earning that sort of money was pretty serious stuff. But also, it's kind of odd equanimity that he could just allow the massive ego of Joe Zawinul to sort of push him to one side. But marvellous player.
And fantastic composer as well. I think it's really worth saying that he composed just a number of just eternal jazz standards. I mean, ESP, Speak No Evil, Footprints, all of those are just wonderful pieces of music. and to combine that kind of composition with the improvisation that he did, I think he was a great. His tone isn't always my favourite, but as a musician all round, I think he's huge. And also managed to cross over, you know, doing the jazz. Fusion jazz rock stuff, but also playing on like Joni albums and doing all this stuff in a way that seemed totally natural and easygoing.
He has a way with a sparse melody, which is very rare in jazz players. He can just play like four notes and they hang there and work beautifully.
Great very record nice. With his Milton Nascimento, Native Dancer, is a lovely album.
Yeah, and his playing on the Joni Mitchell records, especially the one she did with Vince Mendoza, the string arrangements of...
Yes.
His playing is gorgeous. Beautiful on that.
She absolutely adored him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting that he had this very open mind around Weather Report. I really do love Weather Report, even if, you know, it's clearly Zawinul dominated. But when you hear Shorter playing within that funky, cosmic sort of sound, I think it's very, very beautiful.
That funky, cosmic sound.
Copyright by the Oscars.
And a thoroughly nice man by all accounts I mean, really I read a really nice piece on NPR. Michelle Mercer, his biographer, wrote a lovely tribute to him and just tells this great story of like she's on a real deadline of getting the book done, and he's quite discursive normally in their interviews, but she's got like 2 weeks left and she needs to get some stuff nailed down, and then he sort of starts going off on one and his wife goes, Wayne, she's on a deadline, she's got 2 weeks, and then suddenly he just starts, you know, giving her exactly all the answers that she needs in perfect recall, perfect, you know, it's just...
Sentences.
It's just very fun and yeah, big loss.
Two figures that we've lost more recently in the last few days, Gary Rossington of Lynyrd Skynyrd and the great David Lindley. So we've got pieces pertaining to Skynyrd and a lovely piece about David Lindley in which Stephen Rosen drops by Lindley's house in Claremont and there's all these sort of extraordinary, you know, old instruments around. I mean, many listeners will know Lindley from particularly his association with Jackson Browne over the years. I mean,
I knew him from Terry Reid.
Right.
Before Jackson, he was with Terry Reid with Alan White on drums and Lee Miles from Ike and Tina Turner on bass.
Wow.
And so I heard that sound. I booked Terry Reid when I was at Loughborough, and that was the lineup. I think Alan White, Lee Miles, and David Lindley. And so that sound, I mean, even though it was a pedal steel, not a pedal steel,
so
but
lap
steel. Lap steel.
Yes.
That has been played by millions of people, you know, in country music. But he made it sound like nothing else.
Yes.
And so that was, I mean, I saw Terry a few weeks ago.
Did you?
Just before David died, in fact, we were talking about that lineup. I don't know if you've ever done a Terry Reid pages, but his life story is extraordinary.
Yes.
But, you know, Lindley was a major part of that. In fact, he left Terry Reid to join Jackson.
You're a Lindley fan, I think, Martin.
He had a great sense of humour as well. You could think of his vocal on Stay.
Yes.
Yeah, on the Live Jackson album.
And his fiddle playing on Cocaine is incredible as well.
He just added a personality to all the records he ever played on.
Yeah.
I mean, Terry Reid's River was when he was... That was the album when he was working with Terry.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, he just added another personality.
Well, particularly added a real edge to, I think, a lot of Jackson's music, which, you know... Some people would say might be a bit bland at times. And then you've got these extraordinary things that Lindley is doing on things like Running on Empty.
Yes.
And so forth. I think it just gives it this sort of raw kind of edge that I absolutely love. He was a phenomenal player.
Fantastic.
And I think the tributes to him from everyone have been so fulsome. Because he was obviously hugely, hugely liked.
Yes. Yeah. Real eccentric. Yeah. Savant kind of figure as well, I think. Gary Rossington, of course, you know,
survived the crash.
He was the only remaining survivor, wasn't he?
Yeah, but he's one of the three who survived the plane crash.
Skinner's. He was the co-writer on Sweet Home Alabama. Yeah, and Simple Man, not Free Bird.
That must have helped pay the rent over the years.
It may have done. Yeah, right. I saw Skinner at Nebworth. That was the only time I saw them. Just all these southern dudes with hats and
that old Great West Test special
filmed at the Capricorn headquarters.
Yes, it was. It was that's a kind of PR right. thing for Capricorn.
Yes, yes.
Had all those bands.
Anyway, we now have even less time.
I just a couple of things to mention that's gone on. Is that last week we put in an interview with Ralph Hutter of Kraftwerk. Did I pronounce that?
You did a pretty good job.
Yeah. German speaker, Jasper here.
German correspondent.
Which I just recommend that everyone reads who's interested in Kraftwerk, because I think it may be one of the best interviews I've ever read with one of that band. Because Tim Lott, who's a very good writer and has turned into a very good fiction writer, was the writer concerned. And they talk as equals about things like Sachlichkeit and other critical...
And what is that?
Objectivity.
This week, just one quote. It's Jack Good being interviewed by Maureen Cleave for the Evening Standard in 63 on seeing Tommy Steele. He says, "I hadn't been so excited since I saw a match between Spurs and Arsenal. The greatest thing since Olivier as Hotspur. I thought to myself, clearly this is the life." And I love it. It's a Tommy Steele.
I love the Spurs, Hotspur.
It's another great Maureen Cleave interview. As you know, I'm a massive fan of Maureen Cleave.
Did you know Maureen?
No.
And she's just very good at getting really interesting stuff out of people and then putting it in the pages of the Evening Standard. Mm. And that's really something. When anyone claims that American men invented music journalism in 1966, it's like, fuck off, read Maureen Cleave in 1963.
I'm a Nick Tosh's fan.
Yes. Yeah. Though, actually, the awful thing about Nick Tosh is that, I mean, he's just brilliant, but sometimes you read a thing and it just makes you slightly cringe in terms of the way he talks about women.
Well, him and a lot of writers.
But he's a fantastic writer.
Incredible.
Dean Martin.
I love his Sonny Liston book, Night Train.
I don't know.
It's fantastic.
The Dino book, Dean Martin, is a must read. Yeah.
Also, I mean, Nick Tosh has just hung out with Jerry Lewis in a way that most people simply couldn't have, you know.
And survive.
Live to tell the tale. Yeah, it's a great book.
I think
that brings us to a close. So,
can I just ask one question, Rob? Because we've talked about all these monstrous worldwide hits. What artists did you work with that it never happened for, who you thought could have been big?
Well, I can come back to Terry Reid. There's a thing that happens, I have to tell my nephew this, but it hasn't happened to him yet. When you have phenomenal success with something you've done mostly on your own, which I did with Enya, he did with Adele, after Enya sold 13 million records for a record no one ever saw coming, you have this power that I can do anything I want. Anything I touch will turn to gold.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it in lots of other people, but I've had it in myself. And I thought, I love Terry Reid, and he's never had the success he deserved. So I'm going to make a record with Terry Reid, and it's going to be phenomenal. And I made the record. It didn't work. And I suddenly came back down to earth.
Right.
And it was something, it was a moment I think everyone who has a phenomenal success needs to have. And I'm still waiting for Jonathan to have it. But the Terry Reid's album called The River is, I'm so proud of it as a record. And it is that one time dinner with Chris Blackwell. We spent the whole dinner talking about our failures. You know, it started with Jess Roden.
Yeah, Jess Roden, yes, absolutely.
So it's interesting you mention this because Robert Palmer, in a way, was one of those guys who did make it. Because they're not dissimilar singers. I mean, Terry Reid, Robert Palmer, they're of that sort of British blue-eyed soul sort of thing.
Yeah.
And Robert Palmer made it. All the Jess Rodens, Terry Reid's.
I thought Jess Roden, because I saw him. He used to be in a band called Shakedown Sounds in 65. Yeah. And I always thought, now this is, because he had what Rod Stewart had and what Stevie Winwood had. He had all of that wrapped up in one, and he looked great in the modern era. He looked fabulous. Yeah. And that's what started me and Chris talking about failures.
Right.
But Terry, Helicopter Girl, is another one. that I thought was a terrific record. And I couldn't talk for 3 days when it didn't chart in the album charts.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons I retired.
Ah.
I thought the highs don't get any higher.
Yeah, yeah.
And the lows are getting far lower.
Oh. Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah. On that happy note.
On that happy note. Okay, so just remains for me to say, do visit Rock's Back Pages, where subscribers can read over 50,000 articles and listen to over 800 audio interviews. People like Leon Russell. Check to see if your local library subscribes to RBP. If not, maybe suggest they take a free trial of the world's largest archive of music journalism. And thank you, Rob Dickens, for joining us today for what's been a really, really entertaining episode.
Thank you.
It's been great fun. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
That concludes episode 148 of the Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Rob Dickens, the host of Barney Hoskins, Mark Pringle and Martin Collier, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rock's Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews at rocksbackpages.com.
We didn't cover much, but
we skimmed the surface. But then that's your fault for being in the business.
Sex Pistols, Malcolm McLaren.
Well,
not even mentioned. Bank Ellis.
Well, we would have been here literally for 4 hours.
Enya.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.